From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ninjas are ubiquitous in pop culture, in movies, video games, television, action figures. But once upon a time, there were real ninjas, and they weren't turtles. Spies, assassins, shadow warriors for the little guy, the anti-samurai of medieval Japan. They couldn't actually fly or disappear, but they came close. When all else failed, they were the ones you called on. Today, we're separating fact from fiction. This hour, On Point, the thousand-year history of the ninja. You can join the conversation. What comes to mind when you think ninja? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The movies have loved them. James Bond had a lot with popularizing them in the West. 1967, You Only Live Twice, played a big part. Here's a scene where James Bond, played by Sean Connery back then, asks the head of the Japanese Secret Service, played by Tetsuro Tamba, about what kind of manpower he has available for an attack on the villain's secret volcano base.
Do you have any commandos here?
I have much, much better. Ninjas. Top secret, Bonsan. This is my ninja training school.
Watch out, the ninjas are in the house. And here's a scene from Shinobi no Mono. This is a Japanese film from the early 60s. Helped popularize ninjas within contemporary Japan. Here they go. Going after to rescue a maiden in distress from villains in this particular episode with the aid of some smoke bombs. Sounds a little noisy for shadow warriors and stealthy assassins, but we're going to explore everything behind it. Joining us right now from London is John Mann, historian, author. In his many books, he's explored the worlds of Genghis Khan, samurai, and China's terracotta army. His new book is Ninja, 1,000 Years of the Shadow Warrior. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. John Mann, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you with us again.
Hi, Tom. Greetings from a chilly but spring. Well, spring is coming to London very soon.
Good. We're glad to hear it. You give us hope. This is a fascinating kind of. There's inevitably some debunking here because so much lore has grown up around ninja over the centuries, I guess. On the other hand, the story itself is quite marvelous. You call the ninja Japan's anti-samurai. What do you mean by that, John?
Well, the samurai were notorious for being extremely overt, colorful, and full of dramatic gestures, very much in public. And the ninjas were exactly the opposite. They were the spies, the occasional assassins, those who were dedicated to secrecy in disguise. And ostensibly, the samurai meant to despise the ninjas because they were so much the opposite in the way that they lived. But in fact, the ninjas were absolutely essential. Everybody knew this, and many samurais did in fact become ninjas, as it were, in their spare time in the areas that the ninjas grew up, which was not a million miles from Kyoto, in places called Iga and Koka.
You also describe how the samurai and the ninja, at least in the sort of golden age of ninja, the early time of ninja, they represented quite different powers, and powers that were at different ends of the social strata and were often in conflict.
They were, because the areas where the ninjas grew up in the Middle Ages, the late Middle Ages, this is, we're talking about 1400 to about 1600.
Mm-hmm.
They were the areas which is basically Mie Prefecture nowadays, which some of you may know. But these were collections of villages in rather beautiful areas of woods and valleys, but famously without the sort of warlords that were tearing the rest of Japan apart. And these areas were determined to remain free of warlords and so united together into communes in self-defense.
It's quite beautiful territory. I've been down that way. I spent 5 years in Japan and went down to the Grand Shrine at Ise, just next door to this area.
Ah, you went straight through the right area then.
Very kind of craggy topography there, not easily invaded by big armies of samurai, but maybe a perfect place for training ninja and for being defended by ninja.
They were perfect. They are today. Ninjas are a very important part of the local economy because they attract tourists. And the countryside is still remarkably untouched. I mean, of course, there are motorways going through it, and the towns are much more developed than they were then. But the hillsides are still much as they were. The woods are still there, the valleys, and it would still be pretty hard to penetrate on foot. And, of course, it's absolutely no good at all for the sort of cavalry battles that were going on elsewhere in Japan.
We think of a lot of elaborate ninja gymnastics and so on, but you also remind us there's a spiritual element here. Take us back to what's called Shugendo and Yamabushi. What are these?
Well, the Yamabushi were the ascetic warriors of the mountains. And Shugendo was the religion, which was based on the ancient Shinto, a sort of animistic religion of Japan. This is before Buddhism, and it's still very popular today. People can still undergo Shugendo training in the woods and valleys of Iga and Koka and elsewhere as well. And it means that you are engaging with the spirits of the of nature, the spirits of the rocks and the trees and the valleys and the streams, and the sort of training that Shugendo priests undergo, initiates undergo, which means really doing a lot of quite fast-paced walking of the hills and valleys. Was also undertaken by the would-be ninjas. And the ninja manuals later on, after they became defunct, the manuals were written. But they did emphasize that the important thing was not the sort of characteristics which you associate with ninjas now, but what they call right-mindedness. And this was indeed spiritual.
I mean, you give us the image of a Yamabushi, or ninja in training, sitting under an icy mountain waterfall for hours. What was going on there?
Yes, well, the idea is that you mortify the flesh, and you do it for spiritual reasons. The ninjas also did this sort of training, but they do it still. And Shugendo adepts do it still today. Yes, one of the items of training that's recommended is that you do indeed sit under a cold waterfall. I remember one of my guides said her grandfather died as a result of doing this. So it still has its dangers today. Of course, if you come through that, then you come through purified and also a good deal tougher than you went in, which is pretty good if you also happen to be a ninja.
The legacy of this history is still well known and well remembered in this area. You tell a wonderful story right at the top of the book about being with a restaurateur somewhere, I guess, down in this area. And he invites you up in the attic of his low Japanese home. And there you find, well, describe it for us, John.
Oh, yes, it was a wonderful experience because this was near a stream where they did this Shugendo training. Now, of course, there's a nice path which you can walk up as a tourist. Then it was pretty rough. And at the beginning of this stream, there's a little village and a restaurant. And the guy I engaged in talk through my guide said, well, he was a ninja. His background, he wasn't himself a ninja, but he came from a ninja family. And then suddenly he said, would you like to come and see what I've got upstairs? So I said, fine. I didn't know what to expect. And we went, wove our way through the tables to a little staircase. We crept up there into the shadows. And he led me round the corner into the attic. And there were what looked like sort of 10 tailor's dummies. I couldn't make out what they were in the gloom. And so I looked closer, and it turned out that they were 10 suits of ninja armor, and they were beautifully made out of small bits of wire woven together. They were black, hooded things, and they, well, they looked like tailor's dummies, but they were in fact inherited from his grandmother, who had inherited from her grandmother, that is his great-great-grandmother. And so I was amazed to discover myself in the presence of objects which had come down through about 300 or 400 years, almost to the time that the ninjas became defunct in 1600. It was a very moving moment.
And not the showy, even gaudy armor of the samurai, but very dark chainmail doublet you describe made of these minute metal rings, kind of almost black peasant costume, armored version thereof.
They look like the well, as I say, the armored version of peasant costumes, of the ninja costumes, which were used when they went out at night to discover the secrets of their enemies. These were extraordinary things to see.
Linking back, John Mann writes, to a time when ninjas were ordinary farmers until called upon to defend not some lord, but themselves, fighting for their families and villages. The new book is Ninja, 1,000 Years of the Shadow Warrior. We're getting the history from John Mann. He joins us from London. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real history of the ninja of Japan, the original Men in Black, or maybe Dark Blue, John Mann lets us know. His new book is Ninja, 1,000 Years of the Shadow Warrior. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. It is a fascinating history as told by John Mann. You call them kind of warriors for a proto-democracy. I guess we have to picture this map again. The region of medieval Japan where you say this emerged, just not so far south of the historic capital of Kyoto, in very rugged territory, and proto-democracy there growing up, away from the warlord's reach? Is that your case, John?
Yes, they were separate from the warlords. They were a collection of villages, and the villagers got together determined to preserve the sort of independence they had. And the way that they did it was to establish village communes, which banded together to make greater communes, if you like. And they signed constitutions. They had village representatives. Of course, you talk about proto-democracy. You're only talking about the top men being involved in this. But the great thing about it was that the lack of warlords. There was no central administration. There were no great castles, such as you see in the rest of Japan. And the villagers wanted to keep it that way. So they created the communes, determined to remain independent. And that was one of the challenges. That was the challenge in this area that was confronted by the great unifier of Japan, Oda Nobunaga, as he brought the country together in the years leading up to 1600.
So for a long time, they were defending their own turf in a period where warlords really ruled almost everything. They managed to hold out. You say they had no hope of defeating them on an open, full-dress battlefield, but in the shadows they had a chance. Then over time, you remind us, they were, every warlord sooner or later had his own ninja. They were farmed out mercenaries, more.
Yes, when the skills were developed in the Middle Ages, and their skills became known across Japan, and so that in the end, many of them were employed as mercenaries. After their destruction, they were also employed as secret agents by the official government, but that came later. At the time, they acquired a nationwide reputation for their skills, and Iga and Koka ninjas were employed all over. And, of course, others were trained locally as well, so that the skills became nationwide, as well as a lot of the people.
Incredibly compelling figures to a lot of people, including some of our listeners. Chris writes to us on Online, Johnny says there are thousands and thousands of practitioners of ninjutsu around the world, including myself, he writes. What's ninjutsu?
Well, ninjutsu means two things, really. One, today, it means it's an aspect of martial arts and is taught as such. But in the records of the ninjas, which were written soon after their destruction around 1600, there is no mention of martial arts at all. The focus is on disguise, secrecy, intelligence, spying, costumes, some weaponry, but not even very much of that. But no martial arts. It's so that ninjutsu, in its original sense, is to do with the whole way of life, the way of life of the ninjas. No martial arts at all. It's quite an interesting changeover that goes on.
So the way of life, then, and what distinguishes it being kind of asceticism? What else?
Well, that would be the training, but the actual daily life was pretty much that of farmers, rich and poor. There were rich farmers, there were people who called themselves samurai, but the ninjas were fundamentally peasants who developed the techniques of peasant farmers and turned them into weapons of war. Themselves and their farm weapons became weapons of war.
John Mann's new book is Ninja, 1,000 Years of the Shadow Warrior. Let's bring our listeners in. Savannah, Georgia, Michael is calling. Hi, Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, how are you doing?
Well, thanks. What do you know?
I had a question, actually. I wanted to ask about the difference between the term ninja and shinobi, and if there was a true difference or if there were a certain origin to those two words.
Between ninja and shinobi, another Japanese word for ninja? Yes, take us there, John Mann.
Very interesting question. Ninja is the derives originally from the Chinese, which means the same thing. It means one who endures in old Chinese, taken over into Japanese, given a mispronunciation. Japanese were always doing this with Chinese words. But there is also an indigenous Japanese word for one who endures, and that is shinobi. And they use the same kanji, the same signs in Japanese, but with completely different pronunciations. It's very confusing for the outsider, but they are one and the same thing.
So same thing, but it does remind us of some of the Chinese origins of the thinking, the approach that ended up being expressed through the ninja culture in Japan. What's the China connection, John?
The China connection goes way back. Of course, if you just studied the samurai, you'd get the idea that there were no such things as spies, assassins, secret agents, and all that. But of course, in military terms, deception, spying, has always been absolutely vital since the very beginning of militarism, and that goes back to China, before the unification of China, before 221 BC, before the first emperor, to the time of the great military strategist Sun Tzu. And it was he who wrote The Art of War and said in it that deception is the most important of all military strategies, and spies themselves have to be nurtured by the successful general. The Japanese, when they first became began to emerge as a culture, were fascinated by all things Chinese, looked to China as the source of their culture, and of course adopted what they could of Sun Tzu. Sun Tzu is called, as they call him in Japan. And so that everybody has always known in Japan that spies are absolutely vital, and that ninjas were therefore absolutely vital. Not, of course, that they were known by that term at the time, but the techniques were known from the very earliest days, and it was they were part of Japanese militarism and then became specialized later on, as we described in Iga and Koka.
And you can, these two regions, and you can feel them running behind the kind of ninja philosophy Sun Tzu writing, and you quote him here, all warfare is based on deception, therefore when capable of attacking, feign incapacity. When active, feign inactivity. When near the enemy, make it seem that you are far away. Strike the enemy when he's in disorder. Avoid the enemy when he's strong. And above all, have foreknowledge of the enemy situation. He says these can't come from astrologic calculation. It must be obtained from men, that is, from spies. And spying was the number one function of the originally, as you describe it, I think, John, of the ninja.
Yes, that's right. Sun Tzu was a very practical man, and all he was really interested in was winning. So if he says that spies are absolutely essential to winning, then you have to take him seriously. And that's certainly what the Japanese did.
Let's go to Derek, calling from Boston. Derek, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello, John.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a my question is coming from one of the big ninja shows right now, Naruto, the animated series. And in Naruto, they have lots of different ninja villages and lands, and they have, like, these alliances and wars. And I wanted to know, is that historically true? Were there a lot of ninja town alliances and wars and backstabbing and things like that?
John?
Yes, they were collaborative, Iga and Koka. In the legends, which infused the ninjas after their after they became redundant in about 1600, they went into legend pretty quickly. And the most recent legends, of course, post Second World War, have Iga and Koka opposed to each other and great rivals, and also magical beings, which is complete rubbish, but rather fascinating nevertheless. And those are the elements that have gone mainly into modern films and modern manga. And so the people get the idea that Iga and Koka were great opponents. In fact, they were all part of the same commune system.
Iga and Koka, these neighboring regions south of Kyoto that gave rise to so much of the ninja culture. You divide that history into lots, but into two big eras, one in which they were kind of defending themselves, and then another in which they became mercenaries all over Japan and sometimes beyond. Describe those two eras for us and the difference.
Well, they were mercenaries at the same time in medieval times. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But after unification, after 1600, they were virtually destroyed as the commune system, but nevertheless found some employment as the secret agents of the shogun, and then were employed by locally as well as mercenaries.
You can see,
but on mm-hmm. absolutely, you know, minute numbers compared to the numbers that originally existed.
So, what were they used for in those days? I mean, I've got listeners writing
secret police.
Secret police. Listeners are saying, are these like special operations forces today in the modern military, or something different?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't know much about the secret police under the shoguns later on, but they would have been used as special agents for hunting down criminals and rooting out opposition. There were only about 200 of them employed by the shogun, which is nothing really compared to the numbers that existed before. But nevertheless, it was enough to keep some of the techniques in their own consciousness. But they were worried enough about their own possible disappearance to actually, for the first time, write down some of the techniques that had made them famous in the first place. And there are three or four manuals of ninja activities. But one should always remember that they were written down when they thought they were disappearing. And it was a sort of PR exercise. They were eager to record what they could do if they were given the chance.
Well, talk about those techniques and what appears to be real and what's legend. You say probably written in one of the most famous accounts by Natori Masataki. But who knows who actually wrote this and what was real? What about what's real and what's legend when it comes to ninja technique?
We talked a little bit about the techniques, but as I say, no martial arts and not so much about weaponry. The techniques were to do with disguise. There were major disguises that they would adopt.
Zen monk, Buddhist monk, merchant, street entertainer, actor,
yes.
Right on down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were seven major disguises, and those were some of them. Important to disguise your speech so that you would have to imitate dialects. You would have to be extremely flattering to hosts so that you get access to households. You would do everything not to give yourself away, but to gain information, and then be able to escape with that information and report back to your boss. So survival was the key essence. That's the essence of ninjutsu. There's no point in acquiring information if you couldn't survive to bring it back home.
And what about, they're all the sort of, and maybe this is Hollywood, but ninja that fly, ninja that walk on water, ninja that disappear. These strain credulity, but they have an origin somewhere in something. What?
Well, if you were an expert in disguise, you could indeed disappear. You would adopt another personality. The old one would vanish. And there you'd be as, a haiku, a poet, a priest, a student. And the previous personality would have disappeared. And the glib explanation is invisibility. Flying, if you're a Shugendo expert and you're good at running over paths in steep valleys and through forests, you could be fleet of foot and thus be said to be flying through a forest. I think that's probably the origin of that. But of course, the reality is that these were legends and appeared only later in the day, not at the time.
And dressed in black, the way we always see the ninja depicted now?
No, not so much black. They recommend navy blue, dark navy blue. Black apparently stands out on a moonlit night rather more starkly than dark blue. And there are, if you go to Iga Ueno today and Koka, you'll see the tourists actually dress up in not just navy blue, but all sorts of garish colours as well. They like the colours, I suppose, for tourist reasons, but the shape is kept. You have the ninja costume with the floppy trousers and the jacket.
But above all, it's subtlety you write here, and even empathy that the ninja practice. Be flexible, be yielding, great sensitivity. And you're quoting from them here saying that, above all, attain the skill of taking the enemy's mind, how clever it
is,
and what a godlike skill to have.
Yes, and the strangest one of all, I found, was do not defeat your opponents. And psychologically, this is quite interesting because, you'd think a ninja was there to defeat the opponents, but not at all. The idea is that you would worm your way into the affections of your opponents in order to gain that information. And if you come over as aggressive in any way, you're likely to set up opposition, and that's no good at all.
So you must nurture your sources, not dominate. This comes to be a very subtle warrior indeed that you're describing in the Ninja John.
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's more in has more in more of a link with modern secret agents placed within another country, where you go out of your way to disguise your origins, fit in with your culture, and nurture your sources.
And bring back the information, the intelligence. John Mann joins us from London. His new book is Ninja, 1,000 Years of the Shadow Warrior. Here's Kelly Williams and Michael Franti with Ninja of Love. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
With great ease, I can scale your walls. I can leap up from the ground to the middle of
what you're talking about.
Dive out head first and land up on my face. I can be invisible and blending with the night. Completely irresistible and fading with the light. Nibbles are sneaky through your skin, swimming through your veins. I stuff my way into your heart, then your brain.
I'm a ninja.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real history of the ninja of Japan, the original Men in Black, or maybe my guest today says dark blue. John Mann is author of Ninja, 1,000 Years of the Shadow Warrior. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. John, we've got questions coming in here on Twitter. Christopher writes to us and asks about their weaponry. He says, were the ninja really so heavily and cunningly armed if simple farmers, could they afford and make such technology?
No, it was all very low tech, the original ninjas. They adapted farm implements mainly for use in their secret activities. Of course, they had swords. But sometimes they didn't take the swords with them. There is a whole range of weaponry. But interestingly, if you go to Iga Ueno today and Koka and look in the museums, the ninja museums, there is a lot of these farm-adapted weapons, hooks and claws and scythes and sickles and knives of various sorts. But there are none of them which are absolutely authentic. Nothing seems to have come down from the Middle Ages to the present, which establishes the authenticity of these weapons. They've been made up from the drawings which are in the manuals, which were all written after the great age of the ninja.
So are you saying no nunchuck? Are you kidding? No throwing stars?
There are shuriken, the throwing stars, but even these are contentious. I ask lots of questions about these. How did you actually use them? And they are terrific things to use. I expect you've thrown one. A lot of people have them. They go into wood with a very satisfying clunk, and they look extremely dangerous. And they have these star-shaped blades. But when you think about it, how do you carry them? How do you whip them out in dark and use them? And
they're poison tipped. How do you not poison yourself?
Well, quite. And supposedly they were sometimes poisoned, but I'm not sure how you would risk using them if they have actually got poison tips and poison blades. I couldn't get to the bottom of this.
You share a historic document.
I was going to say, if any of your listeners can help, I'd be happy to receive any information.
The mystery of the nunchuck, you share a historic document with a list of things that a ninja should carry, and it's a quite modest list. I was struck by
that.
A little string or rope, a pencil, a piece of paper, not much more.
No, it's that's about it. I mean, the important thing is your innate abilities rather than your fighting techniques, because with any luck, you wouldn't be called upon to fight. You to successfully achieve your mission without killing anyone. And because, after all, if you're going to get into a fight, you become somewhat obvious. The point was that you should discover the information that you need, accomplish your purpose, get the hell out, and go back and report.
Let's get a call from Leesburg, Georgia, and Margaret. Hello, Margaret. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi.
Hello. You're on.
How did ninjas scale those walls?
How do ninjas scale those walls? Japanese fortresses
indeed
had very tall walls. How did they? And if they did, how did they?
Yes. If you've ever seen a Japanese castle, a lot of them have these sort of walls like breaking waves, so they become wider at the base.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get quite a way up simply by climbing on the walls. Thereafter, it becomes tricky. Of course, there are ropes. For low walls, there are also... if you've got your sword with you, you can put your sword up against the wall, use that, sling a rope over the top, climb up the rope, bring the sword up behind you. There are various techniques for getting over walls. And also there were special claws, which were adapted farm implements that you could wear on your hands, which would allow you to get a grip on the walls. Also, you can stick knives in the cracks and use the result as a stepladder. Various techniques, but all quite simple, nothing too demanding. They didn't have gunpowder. They didn't have guns that you could fire a claw over the wall, as you see in the Second World War on commando activities. It was all down to you. And with very little help, you were pretty much on your own or in a small team of two or three. That's all.
Though you do have these climbing hooks that they might throw over the top, I guess, some interesting depictions.
Well, the climbing hooks were mainly for you to hold so that you could use them as sort of extended claws, fingers, which would stick into walls or seek out cracks and help you to climb in that way.
Margaret, there you go. A little ninja advice. One more here, Virginia Beach. Virginia, Mika is calling. Hi, Mika. You're on the air.
Hi, John. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, my question is about Kunoichi, the female ninja. I love them. Do you have anything to talk about?
Female...
Which ninja? I didn't...
Female ninja.
Yes, I didn't come across any references to medieval female ninjas. I'm sure there were some, and they've become legendary since, but I couldn't track down anything which I felt was authentic enough to talk about.
That may come as a disappointment to some female ninja fans.
Oh no! Well, they can you can do, you know, martial arts now and what they call ninjutsu now. That's fine, but I'm afraid to say that I came across no authentic accounts.
Here, a listener asks on Twitter, when did ninjas become so glamorized and superhuman? Is it a case of historical playing telephone run amok for centuries? But what about the glamorization? You're suggesting it started quite early.
They were beginning to become legendary in the 17th century, long after they'd become, in effect, defunct, and gone into legend, I think partly because they themselves wished it that, you know, the survivors wished it that way. The families liked the idea of being made into superheroes. Mm-hmm. But really, it only took off in the early years of the 20th century in Japan. And, of course, what happened then was that the Japanese lost the war, martial arts were banned, but came back to life again in quite a big way when martial arts started up again in the 1950s and were popularized in the West mainly as a result of the James Bond film You Only Live Twice, where the Ian Fleming novel of 1959, I think it was. But that was when the idea of the ninjas became popularized in the West, thanks to Ian Fleming. But I have to say that both in the book, You Only Live Twice, and in the film, they're not so much ninjas as commandos. They're just given the term ninja. And it was tremendous publicity for them. But already we're in the world of legend rather than fact.
You talk about the destruction of the ninja in 1600. Maybe it'd be good to remind listeners what happened in Japanese history that led to their kind of disappearance.
Well, in the 16th century, the great there were three great unifiers, and the one who was the great military commander was Odo Nobunaga, mm-hmm. and he pretty much unified the country militarily. And of course, if you're trying to unify a country, what you don't want is a lot of independent villages. So the ninja had to be defeated in order to unify the country completely. This happened in two great campaigns. The first one was led by Nobunaga's son, whose name was Nobuo, and he rather arrogantly mounted an invasion, and which was catastrophic because the ninjas defended themselves extremely effectively and defeated the son. The father then castigated the son, said you can't allow this to stand, planned his own invasion, which was very much larger in 1581. There was a multi-pronged invasion of ninja lands. Mm-hmm. And they were roundly defeated by a vastly overwhelming force. And it was
not to mention just setting the whole place afire, as I recall.
Yes, the strongholds were burned. The ninjas themselves fled, and some survivors then made it to the outside world to the one who took over from Nobunaga, whose name was Ieyasu, who employed some of their number as the secret agents thereafter. But that was, you're talking about 1600 for unification, and the last time the ninjas were actually in use as a fighting force was in a rebellion in 1614 in Shimabara. But that was pretty much it as far as the official ninjas were concerned.
Do you see parallels in the ninja story then to Western figures like Robin Hood or William Wallace or Zorro?
It's hard to see that because, well, I suppose you could call Robin Hood's Merry Men sort of ninjas in a way, English versions thereof. Hadn't thought about that parallel before. I'm just trying to think of other parallels. The closest I can come to a real ninja is, well, he's still alive, actually. But it goes back to a stream in an element of Japanese culture, which is extremely under-recognized in the West. And that is that in the 1930s, when militarism was on the rise, Japan, there was an aspect of Japanese culture that set itself up as international and generous, as spiritual, with a remarkable lack of ego. And this, the people who were like this in the Japanese army set up a spy school called the Nakano Spy School, which was, if you talk about ninjas as anti-samurai, these were the guys who were the anti-militarists. Their aim was to use Japan as a model for freedom of Asian peoples oppressed, in quotes, by colonial powers. Mm. And their idea was that Japan would lead these colonies to independence, to real independence. Of course, what happened then was that Japanese militarism took over in a very big way after Pearl Harbor. And these generous-hearted, idealistic types were sidelined rather dramatically. But there was one man who was placed in the Philippines at the end of the war, who was, I think, you should really consider him as the last of the ninja, and he's still alive. It's Hiro Onoda is his name, and he was the guy who survived for 30 years in the Philippine jungles and came out in 1974, having survived for all those years on his own, really adopting ninja techniques and also retaining the sort of idealism that he had imbibed from the Nakano Spy School, and which was very, very different from what was actually going on in Japan at the time. Quite an interesting story.
Ninjas, or ninjutsu as a counter trend there, across a lot of time. And yeah, I remember the story of him coming out of the jungle in the Philippines, as you say, decades after the end of the war. The whole world was just astonished. Lots of people responding here online on Facebook. Patrick talks about ninja masters of subterfuge, secrecy, and misdirection. Mika says she's from the Koga clan. So she's from your part of Japan there.
She's right from there. She probably knows the area. She probably knows some of the people I talk to.
No doubt. Andrew gives us, it looks like a ninja haiku here. A flock of geese, a herd of cattle, a seemingly empty room of ninja. I don't know. Eric,
nice.
Eric is calling from San Jose, California. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I read a book about ninjas about probably some 25, 30 years ago. And one of the things I remember reading about in there was the use of pyrotechnics. Is that, you know, like smoke powders and things like that? Is that something that you were able to find in your research, or is that something that was kind of purely out of mythology?
John, smoke, fire, pyrotechnics, and ninja?
This was, I think there were certainly elements of that, because the ninja were meant to study a great many different subjects that would help them. And one of them was the sort of the chemical effects that could be produced by various minerals. And that involved explosions. But I haven't come across any references to the use of anything other than smoke. They obviously didn't have firearms. They did not use grenades. They were not encouraged to set mines. So all I've got to go on is the use of smoke as smoke screens, not as weaponry.
For the disappearing ninja. And one more, Bradley in Arlington, Massachusetts. Bradley, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thank you for a fabulous show. On point, Michael Franti and Ninja all together in
yeah,
one.
Yeah, let's go.
Exploding. I wish I'd gotten in sooner. I'm glad we finally got up to the 20th century, but I think we're negligent if we don't help people understand how many people do practice a very eclectic, pragmatic, holistic art that today all over the world. Here in New England, there's probably six or seven training groups. In Vermont, there's a particularly good one.
Is this ninjutsu, ninja technique? What?
Yeah, and they often use the word ninpo taijutsu, the taijutsu just meaning body art. I was surprised that someone, one of the teachers or practitioners, didn't happen to get the heads up and get in a little bit sooner. I'm no expert. I did practice under Dr. Hatsumi's lineage in the early 1990s.
And Dr. Hatsumi is who, Bradley?
He is considered a national treasure in Japan. He's elderly now, but he inherited a number of lineage or ryuha from the ninjutsu traditions. He's world renowned. You can see some wonderful interviews with him on YouTube.
Bradley, I'm so glad for your call, and I despair to say our time is about to run out here. I want to get John Mann's response on the practice today of what's come down in the lineage of the ninja, John.
Well, the modern ninjutsu and Hatsumi himself and Hattori Hanzo, various others, are undoubtedly are terrific at what they do, and they're it's extremely demanding stuff that they teach. But I was trying to, when I was doing this book, trying to authenticate their claim to have ancient lineages that go back to ninja times, and I was unable to do this. Nobody's, you know, sometimes the great modern teachers talk about scrolls that give them authentication back many generations to the Middle Ages. But nobody's actually seen these scrolls. And there is a feeling in the ninjutsu community that maybe they're not, there is no such thing as actual authenticated, or, you know, authenticity in that, in the historical sense.
That's as far as we get to go today, I'm afraid.
Sorry.
The elusive ninja, right there to the end. Yeah. The book is Ninja, 1,000 Years of the Shadow Warrior. John Mann, thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.